Hear now the words.
Greetings. I am Publius, and you, I suppose you know who you are listening to a long-form spoken word presentation on AnonRadio.net.
All right, friends and neighbors. Today's selection continues from last time. This is the promised ghost story, Chapter 29 of The Pickwick Papers by Charles Dickens, The Story of the Goblins Who Stole a Sexton. The title rather implies that this is a story about goblins, not a story about a sexton. Now, I want to remind you right at the outset that these goblins are not your Tolkien, orc creatures. They're a very different sort of goblins that you shouldn't make assumptions about just exactly what kind of creatures those are going to be based on, what you're familiar with from your D&D campaign or what have you, because the word used to be used in a much broader acceptation. Now, let us begin. In an old abbey town down in this part of the country a long, long while ago, so long that the story must be a true one because our great-grandfathers implicitly believed it, there officiated as sexton and gravedigger in the churchyard one Gabriel Grubb. It by no means follows that because a man is a sexton and constantly surrounded by the emblems of mortality, therefore he should be a morose and melancholy man. Your undertakers are the merriest fellows in the world, and I once had the honor of being on intimate terms with a mute, who in private life and off duty was as comical and jocose a little fellow as ever chirped out a devil-may-care song without a hitch in his memory, or drained off a good stiff glass without stopping for breath. But, notwithstanding these precedents to the contrary, Gabriel Grubb was an ill-conditioned, cross-grained, surly fellow, a morose and lonely man, who consorted with nobody but himself and an old wicker bottle which fitted into his large, deep waistcoat pocket, and who eyed each merry face as it passed him by with such a deep scowl of malice and ill-humor as it was difficult to meet without feeling something the worse for. A little before twilight one Christmas Eve, Gabriel shouldered his spade, lighted his lantern, and betook himself towards the old churchyard, for he had got a grave to finish by next morning, and feeling very low, he thought it might raise his spirits, perhaps, if he went on with his work at once. As he went his way up the ancient street, he saw the cheerful light of the blazing fires gleam through the old casements, and heard the loud laugh and the cheerful shouts of those who were assembled around them. He marked the bustling preparations for next day's cheer, and smelled the numerous savory odors consequent thereon as they steamed up from the kitchen windows in clouds. All this was gall and wormwood to the heart of Gabriel Grubb, and when groups of children bounded out of the houses, tripped across the road, and were met, before they could knock at the opposite door, by half a dozen curly-headed little rascals who crowded round them as they flocked upstairs to spend the evening in their Christmas games, Gabriel smiled grimly, and clutched the handle of his spade with a firmer grasp as he thought of measles, scarlet fever, thrush, whooping cough, and a good many other sources of consolation besides. In this happy frame of mind, Gabriel strode along, returning a short sullen growl to the good-humored greetings of such of his neighbors as now and then passed him, until he turned into the dark lane which led to the churchyard. Now, Gabriel had been looking forward to reaching the dark lane, because it was, generally speaking, a nice, gloomy, mournful place, into which the townspeople did not much care to go except in broad daylight and when the sun was shining. Consequently, he was not a little indignant to hear a young urchin roaring out some jolly song about a Merry Christmas in this very sanctuary which had been called Coffin Lane ever since the days of the old abbey and the time of the shaven-headed monks. As Gabriel walked on and the voice drew nearer, he found it proceeded from a small boy who was hurrying along to join one of the little parties in the old street, and who, partly to keep himself company and partly to prepare himself for the occasion, was shouting out the song at the highest pitch of his lungs. So Gabriel waited until the boy came up, and then dodged him into a corner and rapped him over the head with his lantern 5 or 6 times, just to teach him to modulate his voice. And as the boy hurried away with his hand to his head, singing quite a different sort of tune, Gabriel Grubb chuckled very heartily to himself and entered the churchyard, locking the gate behind him. He took off his coat, set down his lantern, and getting into the unfinished grave, worked at it for an hour or so with a right good will. But the earth was hardened with the frost, and it was no very easy matter to break it up and shovel it out. And although there was a moon, it was a very young one, and shed little light upon the grave, which was in the shadow of the church. At any other time, these obstacles would have made Gabriel Grubb very moody and miserable, but he was so well pleased with having stopped the small boy's singing that he took little heed of the scanty progress he had made and looked down into the grave when he had finished work for the night with grim satisfaction, murmuring as he gathered up his things, "Brave lodgings for one, brave lodgings for one. A few feet of cold earth when life is done. A stone at the head, a stone at the feet, a rich juicy meal for the worms to eat. Rank grass overhead and damp clay around. Brave lodgings for one, these, in holy ground." "Ho, ho," laughed Gabriel Grubb, as he sat himself down on a flat tombstone, which was a favorite resting place of his, and drew forth his wicker bottle. "A coffin at Christmas! A Christmas box! Ho, ho, ho!" "Ho, ho, ho!" repeated a voice, which sounded close behind him. Gabriel paused in some alarm, in the act of raising the wicker bottle to his lips, and looked around. The bottom of the oldest grave about him was not more still and quiet than the churchyard in the pale moonlight. The cold hoarfrost glistened on the tombstones and sparkled like rows of gems among the stone carvings of the old church. The snow lay hard and crisp upon the ground and spread over the thickly strewn mounds of earth, so white and smooth a cover that it seemed as if corpses lay there, hidden only by their winding sheets. Not the faintest rustle broke the profound tranquility of the solemn scene. Sound itself appeared to be frozen up. All was so cold and still. "It was the echoes," said Gabriel Grubb, raising the bottle to his lips again. "It was not," said a deep voice. Gabriel started up and stood rooted to the spot with astonishment and terror, for his eyes rested on a form that made his blood run cold. Seated on an upright tombstone, close to him, was a strange, unearthly figure, whom Gabriel felt at once was no being of this world. His long, fantastic legs, which might have reached the ground, were cocked up and crossed after a quaint, fantastic fashion. His sinewy arms were bare, and his hands rested on his knees. On his short, round body, he wore a close covering ornamented with small slashes. A short cloak dangled at his back. The collar was cut into curious peaks, which served the goblin in lieu of ruff or neckerchief, and his shoes curled up at his toes into long points. On his head he wore a broad-brimmed sugarloaf hat, garnished with a single feather. The hat was covered with a white frost, and the goblin looked as if he had sat on the same tombstone very comfortably for 200 or 300 years. He was sitting perfectly still. His tongue was put out as if in derision, and he was grinning at Gabriel Grubb with such a grin as only a goblin could call up. "It was not the echoes," said the goblin. Gabriel Grubb was paralyzed and could make no reply.
What do you do here on Christmas Eve? Said the goblin sternly.
I came to dig a grave, sir, stammered Gabriel Grubb.
What man wanders among graves and churchyards on such a night as this? Cried the goblin.
Gabriel Grubb! Gabriel Grubb! Screamed a wild chorus of voices that seemed to fill the churchyard. Gabriel looked fearfully around. Nothing was to be seen.
What have you got in that bottle? Said the goblin.
Hollands, sir? Replied the sexton, trembling more than ever, for he had bought it of the smugglers, and he thought that perhaps his questioner might be in the excise department of the goblins.
Who drinks Hollands alone and in a churchyard on such a night as this? Said the goblin.
Gabriel Grubb! Gabriel Grubb! Exclaimed the wild voices again.
The goblin leered maliciously at the terrified sexton, and then raising his voice, exclaimed, And who, then, is our fair and lawful prize?
To this inquiry, the invisible chorus replied, in a strain that sounded like the voices of many choristers singing to the mighty swell of the old church organ, a strain that seemed borne to the sexton's ears upon a wild wind, and to die away as it passed onward, but the burden of the reply was still the same.
Gabriel Grubb! Gabriel Grubb!
The goblin grinned a broader grin than before, as he said, Well, Gabriel, what do you say to this? The sexton gasped for breath.
What do you think of this, Gabriel?
Said the goblin, kicking up his feet in the air on either side of the tombstone, and looking at the turned-up points with as much complacency as if he had been contemplating the most fashionable pair of Wellingtons in all Bond Street.
It's very curious, sir, replied the sexton, half-dead with fright. Very curious, and very pretty, but I think I'll go back and finish my work, sir, if you please.
Work, said the goblin. What work?
The grave, sir, making the grave, stammered the sexton.
Oh, the grave, eh? Said the goblin. Who makes graves at a time when all other men are merry and takes pleasure in it?
Again the mysterious voices replied, Gabriel Grubb! Gabriel Grubb!
I am afraid my friends want you, Gabriel, said the goblin, thrusting his tongue farther into his cheek than ever, and a most astonishing tongue it was. I'm afraid my friends want you, Gabriel, said the goblin.
Under favor, sir, replied the horror-stricken sexton. I don't think they can, sir. They don't know me, sir. I don't think the gentlemen have ever seen me, sir.
Oh, yes, they have, replied the goblin. We know the man with the sulky face and grim scowl that came down the street tonight, throwing his evil looks at the children and grasping his burying spade the tighter. We know the man who struck the boy in the envious malice of his heart, because the boy could be merry and he could not. We know him. We know him.
Here the goblin gave a loud, shrill laugh, which the echoes returned twentyfold, and throwing his legs up in the air, stood upon his head, or rather upon the very point of his sugar-loaf hat, on the narrow edge of the tombstone, whence he threw a somerset with extraordinary agility right to the sexton's feet, at which he planted himself in the attitude in which tailors generally sit upon the shop-board.
I am afraid I must leave you, sir, said the sexton, making an effort to move.
Leave us! Said the goblin. Gabriel Grubb going to leave us. Ho, ho, ho.
As the goblin laughed, the sexton observed for one instant a brilliant illumination within the windows of the church, as if the whole building were lighted up. It disappeared. The organ pealed forth a lively air,
and a whole troops of goblins, the very counterpart of the first one, poured into the churchyard and began playing at leapfrog with the tombstones, never stopping for an instant to take breath, but overing the highest among them, one after the other, with the most marvelous dexterity. The first goblin was a most astonishing leaper, and none of the others could come near him. Even in the extremity of his terror, the sexton could not help observing that while his friends were content to leap over the common-sized gravestones, the first one took the family vaults, iron railings, and all with as much ease as if they had been so many street posts. At last, the game reached to a most exciting pitch. The organ played quicker and quicker, and the goblins leapt faster and faster, coiling themselves up, rolling head over heels upon the ground, and bounding over the tombstones like footballs. The sexton's brain whirled round with the rapidity of the motion he beheld, and his legs reeled beneath him as the spirits flew before his eyes. When the Goblin King, suddenly darting towards him, laid his hand upon his collar and sank with him through the earth. When Gabriel Grubb had had time to fetch his breath, which the rapidity of his descent had, for the moment, taken away, he found himself in what appeared to be a large cavern, surrounded on all sides by crowds of goblins, ugly and grim. In the center of the room, on an elevated seat, was stationed his friend of the churchyard, and close behind him stood Gabriel Grubb himself, without power of motion. "Cold tonight," said the king of the goblins. "Very cold. A glass of something warm here." At this command, half a dozen officious goblins, with a perpetual smile upon their faces, whom Gabriel Grubb imagined to be courtiers on that account, hastily disappeared and presently returned with a goblet of liquid fire, which they presented to the king. "Ah!" cried the goblin, whose cheeks and throat were transparent as he tossed down the flame. "This warms one indeed. Bring a bumper of the same for Mr. Grubb." It was in vain for the unfortunate sexton to protest that he was not in the habit of taking anything warm at night. One of the goblins held him, while another poured the blazing liquid down his throat. The whole assembly screeched with laughter as he coughed and choked and wiped away the tears which gushed plentifully from his eyes after swallowing the burning draught. "And now," said the king, fantastically poking the taper corner of his sugarloaf hat into the sexton's eye, and thereby occasioning him the most exquisite pain, "and now, show the man of misery and gloom a few of the pictures from our own great storehouse." As the goblin said this, a thick cloud which obscured the remoter end of the cavern rolled gradually away, and disclosed, apparently at a great distance, a small and scantily furnished but neat and clean apartment. A crowd of little children were gathered round a bright fire, clinging to their mother's gown and gamboling about her chair. The mother occasionally rose and drew aside the window curtain as if to look for some expected object. A frugal meal was ready spread upon the table, and an elbow chair was placed near the fire. A knock was heard at the door. The mother opened it, and the children crowded round her and clapped their hands for joy as their father entered. He was wet and weary, and shook the snow from his garments as the children crowded round him, and seizing his cloak, hat, stick, and gloves with busy zeal, ran with them from the room. Then, as he sat down to his meal by the fire, the children climbed about his knee, and the mother sat by his side, and all seemed happiness and comfort. But a change came upon the view almost imperceptibly. The scene was altered to a small bedroom, where the fairest and youngest child lay dying. The roses had fled from his cheek, and the light from his eye, and even as the sexton looked upon him with an interest he had never felt or known before, he died. His young brothers and sisters crowded round the bed, and seized his tiny hand, so cold and heavy, but they shrank back from its touch, and looked with awe on his infant face, for calm and tranquil as it was, and sleeping in rest and peace as the beautiful child seemed to be, they saw that he was dead, and they knew that he was an angel looking down upon and blessing them from a bright and happy heaven. Again the light cloud passed across the picture, and again the subject changed. The father and mother were old and helpless now, and the number of those about them was diminished more than half. But content and cheerfulness sat on every face and beamed in every eye as they crowded round the fireside and told and listened to old stories of earlier and bygone days. Slowly and peacefully the father sank into the grave, and soon after the sharer of all his cares and troubles followed him to a place of rest. The few who yet survived them kneeled by their tomb and watered the green turf which covered it with their tears, then rose and turned away, sadly and mournfully, but not with bitter cries or despairing lamentations, for they knew that they should one day meet again, and once more they mixed with the busy world, and their content and cheerfulness were restored. The cloud settled upon the picture and concealed it from the sexton's view.
"What do you think of that?" said the goblin, turning his large face towards Gabriel Grubb.
Gabriel murmured out something about its being very pretty, and looked somewhat ashamed as the goblin bent his fiery eyes upon him.
"You miserable man!" said the goblin in a tone of excessive contempt. "You!"
He appeared disposed to add more, but indignation choked his utterance, so he lifted up one of his very pliable legs, and, flourishing it above his head a little to ensure his aim, administered a good sound kick to Gabriel Grubb, immediately after which all the goblins in waiting crowded around the wretched sexton and kicked him without mercy, according to the established and invariable custom of courtiers upon earth, who kick whom royalty kicks and hug whom royalty hugs.
"Show him some more," said the king of the goblins.
At these words the cloud was dispelled, and a rich and beautiful landscape was disclosed to view. There is just such another to this day within half a mile of the old abbey town. The sun shone from out the clear blue sky, the water sparkled beneath his rays, and the trees looked greener and the flowers more gay beneath its cheering influence. The water rippled on with a pleasant sound. The trees rustled in the light wind that murmured among their leaves. The birds sang upon the boughs, and the lark caroled on high her welcome to the morning. Yes, it was morning, the bright, balmy morning of summer. The minutest leaf, the smallest blade of grass, was instinct with life. The ant crept forth to her daily toil. The butterfly fluttered and basked in the warm rays of the sun. Myriads of insects spread their transparent wings and reveled in their brief but happy existence. Man walked forth, elated with the scene, and all was brightness and splendor.
"You, a miserable man!" said the king of the goblins, in a more contemptuous tone than before,
and again the king of the goblins gave his leg a flourish. Again it descended on the shoulders of the sexton, and again the attendant goblins imitated the example of their chief. Many a time the cloud went and came, and many a lesson it taught to Gabriel Grubb, who, although his shoulders smarted with pain from the frequent applications of the goblin's feet thereunto, looked on with an interest that nothing could diminish. He saw that men who worked hard and earned their scanty bread with lives of labor were cheerful and happy, and that to the most ignorant, the sweet face of nature was a never-failing source of cheerfulness and joy. He saw those who had been delicately nurtured and tenderly brought up, cheerful under privations, and superior to suffering that would have crushed many of a rougher grain, because they bore within their own bosoms the materials of happiness, contentment, and peace. He saw that women, the tenderest and most fragile of all God's creatures, were oftenest superior to sorrow, adversity, and distress, and he saw that it was because they bore in their own hearts an inexhaustible wellspring of affection and devotion. Above all, he saw that men like himself, who snarled at the mirth and cheerfulness of others, were the foulest weeds on the fair surface of the earth, and setting all the good of the world against the evil, he came to the conclusion that it was a very decent and respectable sort of world after all. No sooner had he formed it than the cloud, which had closed over the last picture, seemed to settle on his senses and lull him to repose. One by one the goblins faded from his sight, and as the last one disappeared, he sank to sleep. The day had broken when Gabriel Grubb awoke, and found himself lying at full length on the flat gravestone in the churchyard, with the wicker bottle lying empty by his side, and his coat, spade, and lantern, all well whitened by the last night's frost, scattered on the ground. The stone on which he had first seen the goblin seated stood bolt upright before him, and the grave at which he had worked the night before was not afar off. At first, he began to doubt the reality of his adventures, but the acute pain in his shoulders when he attempted to rise assured him that the kicking of the goblins was certainly not ideal. He was staggered again by observing no traces of footsteps in the snow on which the goblins had played at leapfrog with the gravestones, but he speedily accounted for this circumstance when he remembered that, being spirits, they would leave no visible impression behind them. So, Gabriel Grubb got on his feet as well as he could, for the pain in his back, and brushing the frost off his coat, put it on, and turned his face toward the town. But he was an altered man, and he could not bear the thought of returning to a place where his repentance would be scoffed at, and his reformation disbelieved. He hesitated for a few moments, and then turned away to wander where he might, and seek his bread elsewhere. The lantern, the spade, and the wicker bottle were found that day in the churchyard. There were a great many speculations about the sexton's fate at first, but it was speedily determined that he had been carried away by the goblins, and there were not wanting some very credible witnesses who had distinctly seen him whisked through the air on the back of a chestnut horse, blind of one eye, with the hindquarters of a lion and the tail of a bear. At length, all this was devoutly believed, and the new sexton used to exhibit to the curious, for a trifling emolument, a good-sized piece of the church weathercock which had been accidentally kicked off by the aforesaid horse in his aerial flight, and picked up by himself in the churchyard a year or two afterward. Unfortunately, these stories were somewhat disturbed by the unlooked-for reappearance of Gabriel Grubb himself, some 10 years afterwards, a ragged, contented, rheumatic old man. He told his story to the clergyman, and also to the mayor, and in course of time it began to be received as a matter of history, in which form it has continued down to this very day. The believers in the weathercock tale, having misplaced their confidence once, were not easily prevailed upon to part with it again, so they looked as wise as they could, shrugged their shoulders, touched their foreheads, and murmured something about Gabriel Grubb having drunk all the Hollands and then fallen asleep on the flat tombstone, and they affected to explain what he supposed he had witnessed in the goblin's cavern by saying that he had seen the world and grown wiser. But this opinion, which was by no means a popular one at any time, gradually died off, and, be the matter how it may, as Gabriel Grubb was afflicted with rheumatism to the end of his days, this story has at least one moral, if it teach no better one. And that is, if a man turns sulky and drink by himself at Christmas time, he may make up his mind to be not a bit the better for it. Let the spirits be never so good, or let them be even as many degrees beyond proof as those which Gabriel Grubb saw in the Goblin's Cavern. Well, we're only to the half hour now, so I might as well read chapter 30. How the Pickwickians made and cultivated the acquaintance of a couple of nice young men belonging to one of the liberal professions, how they disported themselves on the ice, and how their visit came to a conclusion. Before that, however, I will remark that you might bear some similarity between this story, this chapter 29, and The Christmas Carol, for which Dickens became famous later on. Anyhow, chapter 30. Sam," said Mr. Pickwick, as that favored servitor entered his bedchamber with his warm water on the morning of Christmas Day. "Still frosty? Water in the water in the washhand basin's a mask of ice, sir," responded Sam. "Severe weather, Sam," observed Mr. Pickwick. "Fine time for them as well wrapped up as the polar bear said to himself when he was practicing his skating," replied Mr. Weller. "I shall be down in a quarter of an hour, Sam," said Mr. Pickwick, untying his nightcap. "Very good, sir," replied Sam. "There's a couple of sawbones downstairs." "A couple of what?" exclaimed Mr. Pickwick, sitting up in bed. "A couple of sawbones," said Sam. "What's a sawbones?" inquired Mr. Pickwick, not quite certain whether it was a live animal or something to eat. "What? Don't you know what a sawbones is, sir?" inquired Mr. Weller. "I thought everybody knowed as a sawbones was a surgeon." "Ah, a surgeon, eh?" said Mr. Pickwick, with a smile. "Just that, sir," replied Sam. "These here ones, as is below, though, ain't regular thoroughbred sawbones. They're only in training." "In other words, they're medical students, I suppose," said Mr. Pickwick. Sam Weller nodded assent. "I am glad of it," said Mr. Pickwick, casting his nightcap energetically on the counterpane. "They are fine fellows, very fine fellows, with judgments matured by observation and reflection, and taste refined by reading and study. I am very glad of it."
"They're smoking cigars by the kitchen fire," said Sam.
"Ah," observed Mr. Pickwick, rubbing his hands, overflowing with kindly feeling and animal spirits, "just what I like to see."
"And one on 'em," said Sam, not noticing his master's interruption, "one on 'em's got his legs on the table and is a drinking of brandy neat, while the other one, him in the barnacles, has got a barrel of oysters between his knees, which he's opening like steam, and fast as he eats 'em, he takes aim for the shells at young Dropsy, who's sitting fast asleep in the chimney corner."
"Eccentricities of genius, Sam," said Mr. Pickwick. "You may retire." Sam did retire accordingly. Mr. Pickwick, at the expiration of the quarter of an hour, went down to breakfast.
"Here he is at last," said old Mr. Wardle. "Pickwick, this is Miss Allen's brother, Mr. Benjamin Allen. Ben, we call him, and so may you, if you like. This gentleman is his very particular friend, Mr.
Bob Sawyer," interposed Mr. Benjamin Allen, whereupon Mr. Bob Sawyer and Mr. Benjamin Allen laughed in concert. Mr. Pickwick bowed to Bob Sawyer, and Bob Sawyer bowed to Mr. Pickwick. Bob and his very particular friend then applied themselves most assiduously to the eatables before them, and Mr. Pickwick had an opportunity of glancing at them both. Mr. Benjamin Allen was a coarse, stout, thick-set young man, with black hair cut rather short and a white face cut rather long. He was embellished with spectacles and wore a white neckerchief. Below his single-breasted black surtout, which was buttoned up to his chin, appeared the usual number of pepper-and-salt-colored legs, terminating in a pair of imperfectly polished boots. Although his coat was short in the sleeves, it disclosed no vestige of a linen wristband, and although there was quite enough of his face to admit of the encroachment of a shirt collar, it was not graced by the smallest approach to that appendage. He presented altogether rather a mildewy appearance, and emitted a fragrant odor of full-flavored Cubas. Mr. Bob Sawyer, who was habited in a coarse blue coat, which, without being either a greatcoat or a surtout, partook of the nature and qualities of both, had about him that sort of slovenly smartness and swaggering gait which is peculiar to young gentlemen who smoke in the streets by day, shout and scream in the same by night, call waiters by their Christian names, and do various other acts and deeds of an equally facetious description. He wore a pair of plaid trousers and a large, rough, double-breasted waistcoat. Out of doors, he carried a thick stick with a big top. He eschewed gloves and looked, upon the whole, something like a dissipated Robinson Crusoe. Such were the two worthies to whom Mr. Pickwick was introduced as he took his seat at the breakfast table on Christmas morning.
"Splendid morning, gentlemen," said Mr. Pickwick.
Mr. Bob Sawyer slightly nodded his assent to the proposition and asked Mr. Benjamin Allen for the mustard.
"Have you come far this morning, gentlemen?" inquired Mr. Pickwick.
"Blue Lion at Muggleton," briefly responded Mr. Allen.
"You should have joined us last night," said Mr. Pickwick.
"So we should," replied Bob Sawyer, "but the brandy was too good to leave in a hurry, wasn't it, Ben?"
"Certainly,"
said Mr. Benjamin Allen. "And the cigars were not bad, or the pork chops either, were they, Bob?"
"Decidedly not," said Bob. The particular friends resumed their attack upon the breakfast more freely than before, as if the recollection of last night's supper had imparted a new relish to the meal.
"Peg away, Bob," said Mr. Allen to his companion encouragingly.
"So I do," replied Bob Sawyer, and so, to do him justice, he did.
"Nothing like dissecting to give one an appetite," said Mr. Bob Sawyer, looking round the table.
Mr. Pickwick slightly shuddered.
"By the by, Bob," said Mr. Allen, "have you finished that leg yet?"
"Nearly," replied Sawyer, helping himself to half a fowl as he spoke. "It's a very muscular one for a child's."
"Is it?" inquired Mr. Allen carelessly.
"Very," said Bob Sawyer, with his mouth full.
"I've put my name down for an arm at our place," said Mr. Allen. "We are clubbing for a subject, and the list is nearly full, only we can't get hold of any fellow that wants a head. I wish you'd take it."
"No," replied Bob Sawyer. "Can't afford expensive luxuries."
"Nonsense," said Allen.
"Can't indeed," rejoined Bob Sawyer. "I wouldn't mind a brain, but I couldn't stand a whole head."
"Hush, hush, gentlemen, pray," said Mr. Pickwick. "I hear the ladies."
As Mr. Pickwick spoke, the ladies, gallantly escorted by Messrs. Snodgrass, Winkle, and Tupman, returned from an early walk.
"Why, Ben," said Arabella, in a tone which expressed more surprise than pleasure at the sight of her brother.
"Come to take you home tomorrow," replied Benjamin.
Mr. Winkle turned pale.
"Don't you see Bob Sawyer, Arabella?" inquired Mr. Benjamin Allen, somewhat reproachfully. Arabella gracefully held out her hand in acknowledgement of Bob Sawyer's presence. A thrill of hatred struck to Mr. Winkle's heart as Bob Sawyer inflicted on the proffered hand a perceptible squeeze.
"Ben, dear," said Arabella, blushing, have you been introduced to Mr. Winkle?"
"I have not been, but I shall be very happy to be, Arabella," replied her brother gravely. Here Mr. Allen bowed grimly to Mr. Winkle, while Mr. Winkle and Mr. Bob Sawyer glanced mutual distrust out of the corners of their eyes. The arrival of the two new visitors, and the consequent check upon Mr. Winkle and the young lady with the fur round her boots, would in all probability have proved a very unpleasant interruption to the hilarity of the party, had not the cheerfulness of Mr. Pickwick and the good humor of the host been exerted to the very utmost for the common weal. Mr. Winkle gradually insinuated himself into the good graces of Mr. Benjamin Allen, and even joined in a friendly conversation with Mr. Bob Sawyer, who, enlivened with the brandy, and the breakfast, and the talking, gradually ripened into a state of extreme facetiousness, and related with much glee an agreeable anecdote about the removal of a tumor on some gentleman's head, which he illustrated by means of an oyster knife and a half-quartern loaf, to the great edification of the assembled company. Then the whole train went to church, where Mr. Benjamin Allen fell fast asleep, while Mr. Bob Sawyer abstracted his thoughts from worldly matters by the ingenious process of carving his name on the seat of the pew in corpulent letters of 4 inches long.
"Now," said Wardle after a substantial lunch, with the agreeable items of strong beer and cherry brandy had been done ample justice to, "what say you to an hour on the ice? We shall have plenty of time."
"Capital," said Mr. Benjamin Allen.
"Prime," ejaculated Mr. Bob Sawyer.
"You skate, of course, Winkle?" said Wardle.
Yes, replied Mr. Winkle. I am rather out of practice."
"Oh, do skate, Mr. Winkle," said Arabella. "I like to see it so much."
"Oh, it is so graceful," said another young lady. A third young lady said it was elegant, and a fourth expressed her opinion that it was swan-like.
"I should be very happy, I'm sure," said Mr. Winkle, reddening, "but I have no skates."
This objection was at once overruled. Trundle had a couple of pair, and the fat boy announced that there were half a dozen more downstairs, whereat Mr. Winkle expressed exquisite delight and looked exquisitely uncomfortable. Old Wardle led the way to a pretty large sheet of ice, and the fat boy and Mr. Weller, having shoveled and swept away the snow which had fallen on it during the night, Mr. Bob Sawyer adjusted his skates with a dexterity which, to Mr. Winkle, was perfectly marvelous, and described circles with his left leg, and cut figures of eight, and inscribed upon the ice, without once stopping for breath, a great many other pleasant and astonishing devices, to the excessive satisfaction of Mr. Pickwick, Mr. Tupman, and the ladies, which reached a pitch of positive enthusiasm when old Wardle and Benjamin Allen, assisted by the aforesaid Bob Sawyer, performed some mystic evolutions which they called a reel. All this time, Mr. Winkle, with his face and hands blue with the cold, had been forcing a gimlet into the sole of his feet, and putting his skates on with the points behind, and getting the straps into a very complicated and entangled state with the assistance of Mr. Snodgrass, who knew rather less about skates than a Hindu. At length, however, with the assistance of Mr. Weller, the unfortunate skates were firmly screwed and buckled on, and Mr. Winkle was raised to his feet. "Now then, sir," said Sam in an encouraging tone, "off with you, and show him how to do it." Stop, Sam, stop," said Mr. Winkle, trembling violently, and clutching hold of Sam's arms with the grasp of a drowning man. "How slippery it is, Sam." "Not an uncommon thing upon ice, sir," replied Mr. Weller. "Hold on, sir." This last observation of Mr. Weller's bore reference to a demonstration Mr. Winkle made at the instant of a frantic desire to throw his feet in the air and dash the back of his head on the ice.
These are very awkward skates, ain't they, Sam?" inquired Mr. Winkle, staggering.
"I'm afeard there's an awkward gentleman in 'em, sir," replied Sam.
"Now, Winkle," cried Mr. Pickwick, quite unconscious that there was anything the matter.
"Come, the ladies are all anxiety."
"Yes, yes," replied Mr. Winkle with a ghastly smile. "I'm coming."
"Just a-going to begin," said Sam, endeavoring to disengage himself. "Now, sir, start off."
"Stop an instant, Sam," gasped Mr. Winkle, clinging most affectionately to Mr. Weller. "I find I've got a couple of coats at home that I don't want, Sam. You may have them, Sam."
"Thank you, sir," replied Mr. Weller.
"Never mind touching your hat, Sam," said Mr. Winkle hastily. "You needn't take your hand away to do that. I meant to have given you 5 shillings this morning for a Christmas box, Sam. I'll give it to you this afternoon, Sam."
"You're very good, sir," replied Mr. Weller.
"Just hold me at first, Sam, will you?" said Mr. Winkle. "There, that's right. I shall soon get the way of it, Sam. Not too fast, Sam, not too fast."
Mr. Winkle, stooping forward with his body half doubled up, was being assisted over the ice by Mr. Weller in a very singular and unswan-like manner, when Mr. Pickwick most innocently shouted from the opposite bank,
"Sam!
Sir!
Here, I want you."
"Let go, sir," said Sam. "Don't you hear the governor calling? Let go, sir." With a violent effort, Mr. Weller disengaged himself from the grasp of the agonized Pickwickian, and in so doing administered a considerable impetus to the unhappy Mr. Winkle. With an accuracy which no degree of dexterity or practice could have ensured, that unfortunate gentleman bore swiftly down into the center of the reel at the very moment when Mr. Bob Sawyer was performing a flourish of unparalleled beauty. Mr. Winkle struck wildly against him, and with a loud crash, they both fell heavily down. Mr. Pickwick ran to the spot. Bob Sawyer had risen to his feet, but Mr. Winkle was far too wise to do anything of the kind in skates. He was seated on the ice, making spasmodic efforts to smile, but anguish was depicted on every lineament of his countenance.
"Are you hurt?" inquired Mr. Benjamin Allen, with great anxiety.
"Not much," said Mr. Winkle, rubbing his back very hard.
"I wish you'd let me bleed you," said Mr. Benjamin, with great eagerness.
"No, thank you," replied Mr. Winkle hurriedly.
"I really think you had better," said Allen.
"Thank you," replied Mr. Winkle. "I'd rather not."
"What do you think, Mr. Pickwick?" inquired Bob Sawyer.
Mr. Pickwick was excited and indignant. He beckoned to Mr. Weller and said in a stern voice, "Take his skates off."
"No, but really, I had scarcely begun," remonstrated Mr. Winkle.
"Take his skates off," repeated Mr. Pickwick firmly. The command was not to be resisted. Mr. Winkle allowed Sam to obey it in silence.
"Lift him up," said Mr. Pickwick.
Sam assisted him to rise. Mr. Pickwick retired a few paces apart from the bystanders, and beckoning his friend to approach, fixed a searching look upon him and uttered in low but distinct and emphatic tone these remarkable words,
"You're a humbug, sir."
"A what?"
said Mr. Winkle, starting.
"A humbug, sir. I will speak plainer if you wish it. An impostor, sir."
With these words, Mr. Pickwick turned slowly on his heel and rejoined his friends.
While Mr. Pickwick was delivering himself of the sentiment just recorded, Mr. Weller and the fat boy, having by their joint endeavors cut out a slide, were exercising themselves thereupon in a very masterly and brilliant manner. Sam Weller, in particular, was displaying that beautiful feat of fancy sliding which is currently denominated knocking at the cobbler's door, and which is achieved by skimming over the ice on one foot and occasionally giving a postman's knock upon it with the other. It was a good long slide, and there was something in the motion which Mr. Pickwick, who was very cold with standing still, could not help envying.
"It looks a nice warm exercise, that, doesn't it?" he inquired of Wardle, when that gentleman was thoroughly out of breath by reason of the indefatigable manner in which he had converted his legs into a pair of compasses and drawn complicated problems on the ice.
"Ah, it does indeed," replied Wardle. "Do you slide?"
"I used to do so on the gutters when I was a boy," replied Mr. Pickwick.
"Try it now," said Wardle.
"Oh, do please, Mr. Pickwick," cried all the ladies.
"I should be very happy to afford you any amusement," replied Mr. Pickwick, "but I haven't done such a thing these 30 years.
"Pooh-pooh, nonsense," said Wardle, dragging off his skates with the impetuosity which characterized all his proceedings. "Here, I'll keep you company, come along." And away went the good-tempered old fellow down the slide with a rapidity which came very close upon Mr. Weller and beat the fat boy all to nothing.
Mr. Pickwick paused, considered, pulled off his gloves and put them in his hat, took 2 or 3 short runs, balked himself as often, and at last took another run and went slowly and gravely down the slide with his feet about 1.25 yards apart amidst the gratified shouts of all the spectators.
"Keep the pot a bilin', sir," said Sam, and down went Wardle again, and then Mr. Pickwick,
and then Sam, and then Mr. Winkle, and then Mr. Bob Sawyer, and then the fat boy, and then Mr. Snodgrass, following closely upon each other's heels and running after each other with as much eagerness as if their future prospects in life depended on their expedition. It was the most intensely interesting thing to observe the manner in which Mr. Pickwick performed his share in the ceremony, to watch the torture of anxiety with which he viewed the person behind gaining upon him at the imminent hazard of tripping him up, to see him gradually expend the painful force he had put on at first, and turn slowly round on the slide, with his face toward the point from which he had started, to contemplate the playful smile which mantled on his face when he had accomplished the distance, and the eagerness with which he turned round when he had done so and ran after his predecessor. His black gaiters tripping pleasantly through the snow, and his eyes beaming cheerfulness and gladness through his spectacles. And when he was knocked down, which happened upon the average every 3rd round, it was the most invigorating sight that can possibly be imagined, to behold him gather up his hat, gloves, and handkerchief with a glowing countenance, and resume his station in the rank with an ardor and enthusiasm that nothing could abate. The sport was at a height. The sport was at its height. The sliding was at the quickest. The laughter was at the loudest. When a sharp, smart crack was heard, there was a quick rush toward the bank, a wild scream from the ladies, and a shout from Mr. Tupman. A large mass of ice disappeared. The water bubbled up over it. Mr. Pickwick's hat, gloves, and handkerchief were floating on the surface, and this was all of Mr. Pickwick that anybody could see. Dismay and anguish were depicted on every countenance. The males turned pale, and the females fainted. Mr. Snodgrass and Mr. Winkle grasped each other by the hand and gazed at the spot where their leader had gone down with frenzied eagerness, while Mr. Tupman, by way of rendering the promptest assistance, and at the same time conveying to any persons who might be within hearing the clearest possible notion of the catastrophe, ran off across the country at his utmost speed, screaming, "Fire!" with all his might.
It was at this moment, when old Wardle and Sam Weller were approaching the hole with cautious steps, and Mr. Benjamin Allen was holding a hurried consultation with Mr. Bob Sawyer on the advisability of bleeding the company generally as an improving little bit of professional practice, it was at this very moment that a face, head, and shoulders emerged from beneath the water and disclosed the features and spectacles of Mr. Pickwick.
"Keep yourself up for an instant, for only one instant," bawled Mr. Snodgrass.
"Yes, do let me implore you for my sake," roared Mr. Winkle, deeply affected.
The adjuration was rather unnecessary, the probability being that if Mr. Pickwick had declined to keep himself up for anybody else's sake, it would have occurred to him that he might as well do so for his own.
"Do you feel the bottom there, old fellow?" said Wardle.
"Yes, certainly," replied Mr. Pickwick, wringing the water from his head and face and gasping for breath. "I fell upon my back. I couldn't get on my feet at first."
The clay upon so much of Mr. Pickwick's coat as was yet visible bore testimony to the accuracy of this statement, and as the fears of the spectators were still further relieved by the fat boys suddenly recollecting that the water was no more where... than 5 feet deep, prodigies of valor were performed to get him out. After a vast quantity of splashing and cracking and struggling, Mr. Pickwick was at length fairly extricated from his unpleasant position and once more stood on dry land.
"Oh, he'll catch his death of cold," said Emily.
"Dear old thing," said Arabella.
"Let me wrap this shawl round you, Mr. Pickwick."
"Ah, that's the best thing you can do," said Wardle. "And when you've got it on, run home as fast as your legs can carry you and jump into bed directly."
A dozen shawls were offered on the instant. Three or four of the thickest having been selected, Mr. Pickwick was wrapped up and started off under the guidance of Mr. Weller, presenting the singular phenomenon of an elderly gentleman dripping wet and without a hat, with his arms bound down to his sides, skimming over the ground without any clearly defined purpose at a rate of 6 good English miles an hour. But Mr. Pickwick cared not for appearances in such an extreme case, and urged on by Sam Weller, he kept at the very top of his speed until he reached the door of Manor Farm, where Mr. Tupman had arrived some 5 minutes before, and had frightened the old lady into palpitations of the heart by impressing her with the unalterable conviction that the kitchen chimney was on fire, a calamity which always presented itself in glowing colors to the old lady's mind when anybody about her evinced the smallest agitation. Mr. Pickwick paused not an instant until he was snug in bed. Sam Weller lighted a blazing fire in the room and took up his dinner. A bowl of punch was carried up afterwards, and a grand carouse held in honor of his safety. Old Wardle would not hear of his rising, so they made the bed, the chair, and Mr. Pickwick presided. A second and a third bowl were ordered in, and when Mr. Pickwick awoke next morning, there was not a symptom of rheumatism about him, which proves, as Mr. Bob Sawyer very justly observed, that there is nothing like hot punch in such cases, and if ever hot punch did fail to act as a preventative, it was merely because the patient fell into the vulgar error of not taking enough of it. The jovial party broke up next morning. Breakings up are the capital things in our school days, but in afterlife they are painful enough. Death, self-interest, and fortune's changes are every day breaking up many a happy group and scattering them far and wide, and the boys and girls never come back again. We do not mean to say that it was exactly the case in this particular interest. All we wish to inform the reader is that the different members of the party dispersed to their several homes, that Mr. Pickwick and his friends once more took their seats on the top of the Muggleton coach, and that Arabella Allen repaired to her place of destination, wherever it might have been. We dare say Mr. Winkle knew, but we confess we don't. Under the care and guardianship of her brother Benjamin, and his most intimate and particular friend, Mr. Bob Sawyer. Before they separated, however, that gentleman and Mr. Benjamin Allen drew Mr. Pickwick aside with an air of some mystery, and Mr. Bob Sawyer, thrusting his forefinger between two of Mr. Pickwick's ribs, and thereby displaying his native drollery and his knowledge of the anatomy of the human frame, at one and the same time, inquired,
"I say, old boy, where do you hang out?"
Mr. Pickwick replied that he was at present suspended at the Georgian Vulture.
"I wish you'd come and see me," said Bob Sawyer.
"Nothing would give me greater pleasure," replied Mr. Pickwick.
"There's my lodgings," said Mr. Bob Sawyer, producing a card. "Lant Street, Borough. It's near Guy's, and handy for me, you know. Little distance after you pass St. George's Church. Turns out of the High Street on the right-hand side the way."
"I shall find it," said Mr. Pickwick.
"Come on Thursday fortnight, and bring the other chaps with you," said Mr. Bob Sawyer. "I'm going to have a few medical fellows that night."
Mr. Pickwick expressed the pleasure it would afford him to meet the medical fellows, and after Mr. Bob Sawyer had informed him that he meant to be very cozy, and that his friend Ben was to be one of the party, they shook hands and departed. We feel that in this place we lay ourselves open to the inquiry whether Mr. Winkle was whispering during this brief conversation to Arabella Allen, and if so, what he said, and furthermore, whether Mr. Snodgrass was conversing apart with Emily Wardle, and if so, what he said. To this we reply that whatever they might have said to the ladies, they said nothing at all to Mr. Pickwick or Mr. Tupman for 8 and 20 miles, and that they sighed very often, refused ale and brandy, and looked gloomy. If our observant lady readers can deduce any satisfactory inferences from these facts, we beg them by all means to do so. Well, that was a very neat 2 chapters, I think. Yes? Two chapters making half an hour each, so that chapter 28, the big Christmas chapter, was a double-length chapter, as indeed is intimated by the note at the end of it. So yes, that's a specimen of the humor of the middle of the early middle of the 19th century. It lacks, of course, the illustrations, because each chapter of the Pickwick Papers was illustrated with a sketch by the great artist known as Boz, artist and caricaturist. And indeed, apparently, the original idea was that Boz would come up with a sketch of gentlemen doing something silly, and Dickens would write a story about it. And so they would proceed chapter for chapter. And this may have been the plan that was followed in the early part of the work, but pretty soon Dickens took the lead. Anyway, the whole matter occasioned a certain amount of controversy in later days as to who really should be credited with the Pickwick Papers. But I think most everybody agrees that Dickens deserves the primary credit for how the story was in its finished form. Anyway, I hope that you have enjoyed this little bit of reading, and I hope that it has given you some idea of how it should come about that the story of the Pickwick Papers should have made such an impression on a lonely little boy in Shanghai in 1910 that he took it upon himself to write a sequel starring the China Dolls and so on, the enormous menagerie, so far as I could tell, of dolls and puppets and stuffed toys that he had accumulated in the course of his sojourn there. Anyway, this has been Hear Now the Words with me, Publius, on anonradio.net. If you want to support these broadcasts of mine, you can go to patreon.com/Publius_reads or paypal.me/Prometheus Lives. But most of all, I would like to get your cards and letters. Send me your comments. Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas, 76101, United States of America. And I know I'm not in the United States right now at the moment, but I will check my mail so soon as I arrive at home. Anyhow, this is Anon Radio, which is a service of the SDF Public Access Unix System, sdf.org. I encourage you to support SDF. It's a wonderful thing. It's a great community, and it's an educational resource and all those things. Anon Radio is one of many intriguing services that it provides. Now, in just 20 seconds, will be ambient techno music with DJ Damaru. At 17 UTC will be open mic. At 18 UTC is open VIP, where you can call in and talk like I'm doing right now. At 19 hours is news to me with MNW. 19:30, the Dubious Goals Committee with Tobe, which is every single day of the year. At 20 hours, Internet Voices of the D.